All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.
Hello listeners, welcome to another edition of All the Rage, and yet again this week I have an interview. Please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name's Jim Jump and I'm the chair of the International Brigade Memorial Trust. Based in London, we're a charity that looks after the story of the men and women who went to fight fascism and defend democracy in the Spanish Civil War. For those of you who don't know, the Spanish Civil War was a precursor of the Second World War. It took place between 1936 and 1939, and in that war, the international brigades, in other words, the people from the British Isles who went to fight alongside the Spanish people, were the first Britons to take up arms against Hitler and Mussolini. They had sent troops and aircraft and equipment to support a coup against the elected Spanish government, and the coup was led by General Franco. General Franco eventually won that war and ruled Spain with a rod of iron and great misery and with great brutality for the next four decades. But we believe that those people, those volunteers who went from Britain and Ireland and from around the world to fight against fascism, are a source of great inspiration. They prevented a fascist victory in Spain for nearly 3 years. They woke the British people up to the dangers of fascism, the unique dangers of fascism in Europe, and allowed time, in fact, for Britain and other countries to rearm. There are many other achievements they made in Spain. They basically, historians now, when they look at the figures, see that Mussolini's army was basically destroyed in Spain. His losses were so great that he couldn't play a major part in the Second World War alongside his friend Adolf Hitler. So there are many reasons to remember the International Brigade. I mean, above all, they are a lasting example of international solidarity. In other words, people from all around British Isles, from the coal mines of Scotland, from the shipyards of the North East, from the mill of Lancashire, workers of all sorts, students, office workers, all sorts of people, from the South Wales miners, sent a big contingent. They rallied to the cause of Spanish democracy. And remember, in those days, Spain was a very remote country. People didn't go on holiday to the Costas, and to go and to travel from, you know, a Fife coalfield, or from South Wales, or from the shipyards of Harland and Wolff or something like that, to go to Spain was an incredible journey. And it was no gap year either. These people, there was 2,500 went from the British Isles, and more than 500 of them, in fact 526 names we have, more than 500 of them died in Spain, were killed there. So, and many more were injured. So you were lucky if you came back from Spain at all, and lucky if you came back uninjured. So it was a terrible sacrifice they paid. And of course it was an enormous tragedy in that the war was won. But as I said, it was the start, 1936, when these people took up arms against fascism. It was effectively the start of the great Second World War against fascism in Europe, which ended in 1945, with the destruction of Nazi Germany.
So, just a little bit about international brigades, in the kind of build-up to them in this country, how they operated. They were part of... If I was a young fella, you know, I'm concerned about what's going on in Spain, in 1936, I wanted to join up, I wanted to get over to Spain. What did I do?
Well, usually people did it. Some went independently. Some had the means and the guile and the wherewithal to do that. But most contacted, usually the Communist Party. The Communist Party then was in the vanguard of the fight against fascism in the 1930s. It took the Labour Party a little bit longer to wake up, but to their credit, they did in the end. And in fact, Clement Attlee, who became arguably the greatest Labour Prime Minister ever, visited the International Brigades and the British Battalion in Spain in 1936 and was a great supporter of their struggle. But certainly in 1936, the Labour Party still was a bit pacifist, basically, and for understandable reasons. It was, in living memory, was the awful slaughter and carnage of the First World War. So it was quite understandable for people to think, well, it's best to keep out of another European conflict. And the policy of the Labour Party, which was initially one of non-intervention in the Spanish Civil War, was based on that principle, that they wanted to avoid a war in Europe, another war in Europe, which would lead to millions of deaths. With hindsight, we can now see that that was not the right stance. I mean, hindsight's a great thing, but obviously, you know, we now know that the fascist dictators were intent on war, had an agenda the like of which European civilization had never seen before, and they had to be stopped. The people who went to Spain said, if fascism is not stopped in Spain, there will be another world war. So the Labour Party eventually came round, in fact, to their annual conference in 1937, agreed to support arms for Spain and the cause of the Spanish Republic, the armed cause of the Spanish Republic. But initially it was the Communist Party that organised the International Brigades, and this is true not just in Britain but around the world, and there are countless examples of people who joined specifically to go to Spain, who recognised the threat of fascism and saw it as a unique threat at that time, and joined the Communist Party so that they could be effectively smuggled through France to Spain. And that's what happened. In fact, that was true of my father. My father had been a member of the Labour League of Youth, the sort of the young wing of the Labour Party, and he left. He was so annoyed that the Labour Party wasn't supporting the struggle in Spain, and joined the Communist Party early in 1937 so that he could get to Spain. And he was one of many similar examples like that.
Yeah, I actually just taking a side issue quickly. I in the magazine for the International Brigades Memorial Trust, which we'll talk about in a second, I did read a very interesting story about people going to the border of France to try and get into Spain and coming back and meeting a lot of opposition then from parts of sort of the French government and that weren't too pleased about it.
Well, the League of Nations, which was the precursor in a sense of the United Nations, but much weaker and smaller scale, but the League of Nations supported this British-led policy of non-intervention. And Britain and France pushed this policy of non-intervention. We now know, however, that that was a very cynical policy. We now know that those people, the architects of that policy, certainly in the Conservative-led government in Britain at the time, knew full well that that would lead to a Franco victory. And now it's quite clear that that policy of non-intervention was part of that wider policy that Baldwin and Chamberlain, the two British prime ministers at this time, their policy of appeasement. They thought that they thought two things. They thought, one, that the best way to deal with the fascist demands for power and hegemony in Europe was to basically toss them a few prizes like Spain and later Czechoslovakia, and then they'd go away. But there was another more aligned side, if you like, to the policy of appeasement, which was that the British ruling class saw the Soviet Union and communism as the real enemy and failed to see that actually the real existing immediate threat and enemy to not just to Britain but to civilization, I mean without overstating it, was Nazi Germany and European fascism.
Yes, well, fortunately we've learned from that mistake, haven't we? I've never repeated such a thing. So let's just put ourselves in a bit of context. So the International Brigades, here we are, they've gone to Spain from all over the rest of the world, from Britain, from France, from Holland, from lots of other places where also, according to the magazine, I found there's a lot of memorials to people, that kind of thing. Yeah. I hope to go and visit the one in Amsterdam at some point, actually.
Yeah.
And even from Palestine and America. And, of course, the one of the interesting things I find, and I'll address this in a minute when we talk about the Memorial Trust, is I'm always finding out new stuff about this that I didn't know. So there is the African-American League, of which I think there's a film about them now, actually.
Well, it's the American Volunteers, and there was about 3,000 of them. They're known as the Lincoln Brigade. They weren't a brigade, they were a battalion, but they call themselves, as a movement, the Brigade. And, they wrote a very special chapter in U.S. 20th century history in terms of civil rights and social justice, in that in Spain it was a fully integrated military unit. I mean, they were all volunteers, obviously, and there was a high proportion of African Americans in the Lincoln Brigade. And in fact, not only were they the first historically integrated unit of American troops, if you can call them troops, but they were also the first to be led by a black commander. And at the Battle of Brunete in the summer of 1937, just west of Madrid, the American soldiers and volunteers were led by Oliver Law, an African-American who in fact was killed in that battle. But he will go down and has gone down in history as the first African-American black commander of an integrated set of US troops. So, but this international—I mean, that's not an isolated example. This was very much an international army. In fact, and that was stressed at the time. The badge of the International Brigade is a three-pointed star, which is—it's very crude to our sensibilities these days, but was supposed to represent the three races of mankind: African, European, and Asian. And there were volunteers from over 50 countries. Then there were many fewer countries than there are today, and there were volunteers from China, from Australia, New Zealand, from Palestine, the Middle East, from all around Europe. There was a Canadian battalion, of course. So it was an extraordinary army, and even the British battalion, in which most of the volunteers from Britain and Ireland served, was in itself quite an international army. Among them, there were many Cypriots, because of the connections with the Empire and the Commonwealth, so a lot of Cypriots joined and came through London and joined the battalion. There were people from around the world. In terms of different communities, there were many, many Jewish volunteers, because they, of course, for understandable reasons, recognised perhaps more starkly than other people the unique threat of European fascism. So there were many Jewish volunteers from Manchester, Leeds, and in particular the East End of London, which sent scores and scores of volunteers to Spain. It was an amazing piece of history of the Jewish community in Britain, in fact.
Yes, very switched on people. One other issue I just want to talk about quickly was Spanish refugees, particularly we had children who we hosted here in Britain, among other places, and they have their own quite special place, I think, in British history.
Well, yes, this is of interest to me, not just generally, but very personally. There was, on the 23rd of May 1937, a ship arrived in Southampton that sailed from Bilbao a few days earlier. The ship was called La Habana, Havana in English, and on it was nearly 4,000 refugee children. They were called the Basque children, but they were from all over that part of northern Spain. And it was while Franco and Hitler and Mussolini were bombing the north of Spain, and everyone has heard or should have heard of Guernica, probably the most famous painting of the 20th century, painted by Picasso in response to that bombing because this was something unique. Nobody, until, I mean, there'd been some limited bombing, very isolated cases of bombing during the First World War of civilian targets. But in Spain, this was the first example of mass bombing of civilian centres of population. Europe had never seen anything like it before, and it wasn't just Guernica, it was Madrid, Barcelona and other cities. This was a horrendous tactic, and of course in a sense we got people got used to it in the Second World War. The Second World War was fought out in the skies to a large degree, and civilian populations, whether in Britain or indeed, it has to be said, in Germany and elsewhere, became targets. But in Spain this was something new, and you only need to look back at how these events were reported at the time to get an idea of how horrendous they seemed. And there's a famous poster produced by the Spanish government, the Republican government, which was fighting against Franco at the time, of a very shocking still of a dead young baby girl, a victim of the bombing, and it said, and they produced it in various languages, but in English it said, if you tolerate this, your children will be next. And of course it was true, our children were next, so it was in response to that campaign of bombing that then Franco and Hitler and Mussolini had unleashed on principally the Basque Country in northern Spain, which was loyal to the Spanish Republic, the democratic government of Spain, that there was a big campaign to bring refugee children to Britain. And the government, conservative-led government, refused, but there was a mass campaign, and they couldn't resist public pressure and public opinion, and they agreed reluctantly to let them in, these 4,000 children, on condition that there would be no drain to public funds, that their upkeep, their health, welfare, education, housing, everything should be done by volunteers and should not drain the public purse. So the people who organised this exodus said, fair enough, and that's what they did. These 4,000 children arrived and they were dispersed to what were called colonies all around Britain, and looked after by volunteers, by trade unions, by political activists, by church groups, by just individual people with humanitarian conscience. And the personal bit of this story is that my mother, Cayetana Lozano Díaz, was one of the adult helpers on that ship. She was on that ship. She was already a refugee. She was from San Sebastian in the Basque Country, and had fled there before the fascist troops entered and had gone to Bilbao. So she was already a refugee in Bilbao, and then when the Basque regional government asked for volunteers to accompany these children to England, she put her name down. She was aged 23 and she arrived, and there were 400 adult helpers, so she was one of those on the ship. There were teachers, nurses, even a few priests, and she was one of these helpers, came to England, and she was sent to one of these colonies with a group of children in Worthing on the south coast. And so this is the summer of 1937, and by coincidence, my father was a newspaper reporter on the Worthing Herald at the time, and also he could speak Spanish, which was very rare at that time, but he'd gone to a school on Merseyside, Wallasey Grammar School, which, because of Merseyside's trading links with principally with South America and the River Plate, had learnt Spanish. And so he was not only an anti-fascist, but he was a Spanish-speaking anti-fascist, and he volunteered to help in this colony, was one of the volunteers, and he met my mother there, and they fell in love, and then my father immediately went off to fight in Spain. Was in Spain. His name was Jimmy Jump, same as mine, and he was in Spain for 13 or so months, and returned in December 1938. He was there. He was wounded at the Battle of the Ebro, but not gravely, and he came back and married my mother, and they settled here, and she settled here in England, obviously, didn't want to go back and live under Franco. So these children, what it was, those 4,000 children, that when that ship berthed and docked in Southampton on that day and those children disembarked, that remains to this day the largest single influx of refugees into Britain. So it was the start, arguably, of something much larger that was going to happen in subsequent years and decades. I mean, obviously, soon after that incident in 1937, we started to get the campaign to get the Jewish children out of Czechoslovakia and Germany and elsewhere in Europe. And in fact, if you look at back at the history of the documents of the people involved, it's often the same people. It's the same people who helped the Bass children, then went on to be involved in the Kinder transport.
And a lot of the newspapers that rejected it are often the same newspapers.
Same people, yeah, it's the same. So there's a continuity here. Yes, it was. yes. And then, of course, that period of the 20th century, of which the Spanish Civil War was the beginning, led to massive displacements of population and influx of refugees, and of course, more Spanish Republicans arrived in Britain by other means at the end of the Spanish Civil War, and indeed at the end of the Second World War, with the collapse of Vichy France and victory of the Allies. So, and of course with many others, I mean, that was when, British society began to change, arguably, isn't it? There'd already been the Jewish influx of refugees in the early 20th century, and they, as I said, played a major role in the campaign against fascism, not only in Britain but in Spain. But then the Second World War brought tens and tens of thousands of new people, and of course, arguably enriched our society.
Just on the volunteerism, I was just going to add a point that there were things already happening. So I remember there was the Communist Party ran things like Aid for Spain, didn't they? Stuff like that. They had a big rally, or were going to have a big rally on the 4th of October 1936, but got diverted to something slightly more important that we've talked about on the show before, so I'll let regular listeners go back and work out what happened on that day in London. However, the International Brigades were not, and the Spanish Republicans were not successful. We did lose that particular war, unfortunately. There are many theories about why it happened. Some can be very controversial. Generally put forward by modern history is the idea that really the left wasn't united enough, they were too factional. Yes, no, some of that true?
Well, I mean, there might be some element of truth in that, but I think it's the problem with that thesis, and it is very commonly espoused, and largely actually because of one book and one film, when we're talking about George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia and Ken Loach's Land and Freedom, both marvellous bits, marvellous works. I mean, the George Orwell book is a fantastic, very vivid account of what it's like to be in a trench, to be fired on by fascists, to be that kind of foot soldier. And of course, a description of the events of May 1937 in Barcelona when the left did fight the left. And then Ken Loach's film, which obviously came out much later in 1995, which again is a fantastic film. I mean, in Spain, people openly weep at it when they see it. So it's a very moving film. But again, it focuses on that part of that history of the Spanish Civil War. In other words, the divisions on the left. Now, I mean, they're interesting in their own way, and they're significant. But they do divert from the bigger picture of the reason why Spain lost, the Spanish Republic lost, was because Britain, France and the other democracies not only failed to help a fellow democracy. I mean, we're not talking about sending British troops over there. No one asked for that. What the Spanish government wanted was to have arms, to be able to buy arms, because the army had... Most of the main units of the army were part of the coup led by Franco and supported by Hitler and Mussolini. So the Spanish government had the people on its side, but had no army. And not only did it have no army, it hastily made amends for that and started to create an army, of which the International Brigades were part. But they couldn't buy weapons, and the only weapons they could get were from the Soviet Union. some from Mexico, which supported the Republic, but and some on the black market. But the weapons were always inferior. There were huge logistical problems in getting weapons through from the Soviet Union, because the U-boats in the Mediterranean and elsewhere would sink the Soviet ships. So it was very problematic, and that's the main reason they lost the war, because they were outgunned. And whenever, and I mean, what happened? Well, the way the Spanish government was able to form what it called the Ejército Popular, the People's Army, out of nothing, from scratch, was amazing. And it, and there, it, I mean, Franco expected victory within weeks, and his army swept up. I mean, he brought over what was called the Army of Africa, which was basically the Spanish Foreign Legion from Morocco across, because there was Morocco then was divided between French Morocco and Spanish Morocco, and with the help of airplanes and ships supplied by Hitler and Mussolini, the Army of Africa, that's the elite army of the elite unit in the Spanish army, was brought over and swept up through southern Spain, causing terrible death and destruction and murdering civilians and the like as it went. And it arrived at the gates of Madrid in November 1936. The coup happened in July 1936, so within months they were there at the gates of Madrid. And everyone, the whole world, expected Madrid to fall and the war would be over. But unbelievably, the Spanish people had rallied. There were armed militias run by trade unions and political parties, and the international brigades arrived. I mean, it's an incredible story, but they arrived in November, I can't remember the exact date, and marched up the Gran Via in Madrid with Madrileños, the people of Madrid, in tears, offering them wine and bread and the rest of it, but they marched straight up the Gran Via to the front, which was at the Casa de Campo and just on the edges of Madrid. And unbelievably, they stopped, they saved Madrid, and Madrid never fell. I mean, many people in Madrid are still very proud of that they say Madrid never fell in the war. The fascists only marched in March 1939, when the Republic effectively collapsed.
Yes, and we'll talk about Madrid in a moment. I mean, just feeding back a little bit what you said there, the getting the weaponry from the Soviet Union, I find interesting, because a lot of people now use that as an excuse historically to kind of dismiss this as, oh, it was a front for Stalin or whatever.
No, that's rubbish. Yeah. That's rubbish. Yeah. I mean, there is that thesis that was promoted actually from the right, by the fascists, by Franco, in fact, we now know he made these forged documents, had these documents forged to make out there was some impending communist coup in Spain. Utter nonsense. The documentation has been shown to be forgeries. The Soviet Union wasn't even interested in Spain. The Soviet Union didn't even have an embassy in Spain when the coup started in July 1936. And we now know again. I mean, it's one of these things with history that you get to know more. Which sounds a bit weird, but you get to know more the greater distance there is from when it happened, because of the opening of archives and the rest of it. We now know that Stalin was just simply amazed that he thought this was a fight for Britain and France, and thought Britain and France were crazy to stand back and let Hitler effectively bring Spain into his orbit. And that France would then have a third fascist country on its borders. It would be almost surrounded by fascist countries: Germany, Italy, then Spain.
Who, of course, more importantly, were helping. You know, Germany and Italy were helping.
Yes, that's right.
Something that's kind of forgotten about in the broader.
That's right. So Stalin's policy was to try and get Britain and France to support the Republic. He thought, well, it's their battle, and they must be nuts not to help Spain. And of course, whatever you think of Stalin, he was right about that. And many eminent historians have also said in general terms about Stalin and Spain that Stalin may have been responsible for many crimes, but he certainly wasn't responsible for the defeat of the Spanish Republic. The Spanish Republic was defeated by Franco, Hitler, Mussolini, and arguably the British government, that refused to sell arms to the Republic. the obviously the divisions on the left, such as there were didn't help, but they weren't instrumental in the fascist victory. The fascist victory was because was made possible by superiority of arms. And we also know not just that. We also know not just that Stalin was thinking these things. We now know from the archives that that Hitler and Mussolini were. Franco was a very cautious general. He was the leader of the rebels in Spain, the fascist rebels. He was very cautious, and Hitler and Mussolini kept G-ing him up, saying, "Well, come on, you know, launch an offensive there, and why don't you take that city there, and all that sort of stuff." He was very cautious because they feared, and the reason they were G-ing him up is they feared that in the end, Britain and France would wake up to the fact to what was going on and realise that actually their interests were to save the Spanish Republic. And there's an interesting kind of side parallel to all this in that Winston Churchill's attitude to the war changed 180 degrees. He started off in 1936 being sympathetic to Franco. He was quite sympathetic to Mussolini at the time, it has to be said.
Well, there's speeches he made in the
comments. Yeah. That's right. But as the war went on, he changed. And by the end of the war, he was supporting. It was too late by then. But by the end of the war, he recognised that the Spanish Republic should have been supported. And in speeches during the war, the Second World War, there's one famous speech in which he praised the people of Barcelona for the way they resisted fascist bombardment and likened it to what was being suffered by the British people.
John Bouts, all the rage, all the on Tracks FM. Tracks FM.
There's a valley in Spain called Jarama. It's a place that we all know so well. It was there that we gave of our manhood, and so many of our brave comrades fell. We are proud of the British Battalion and the stand for Madrid that they made. For they fought like true sons of the people, as part of the 15th Brigade, along with the Internationalistas, in the fight for the freedom of Spain. We vowed in that dark valley of Jarama that fascism never would reign. Now we've left that dark valley of sorrow, but its memory we'll never forget. And as we once again fight the fascists, let's remember Jarama and its dead. There's a valley in Spain called Jarama. It's a place that we all know so well. It was there that we gave of our manhood, and so many of our brave comrades fell.
I mean, it's more about you know, the motivation of, I mean, why did the British government stay out of it? You know, I mean, like I said about the First World War, and there's the dark side of they were actually hoping that Hitler and Mussolini would have a pop at the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
But there's, there's a fabulous quote by, so I'll try and work it in later then, that Paul Preston, who says that the British government put its, which is conservative, put its class interest ahead of the national interest.
Oh, yeah.
You know, was that policy of appeasement led to the horrors, the disaster, and the nightmares of the Second World War and all that flowed from it. Yeah. And if they'd only, you know, looked beyond their own narrow class interests, it could have been averted, maybe. Who knows? I mean, it's evidence.
Yeah. I find it interesting that, as you've noted about, Soviet ships were carrying weapons that were sunk by U-boats. You'd think that would be a declaration of a war, that someone like the leader of the Soviet Union would then go, oh, okay, I'll go and
there were British ships being sunk. British ships being sunk. Yes, there was, in the end, Britain had to, I mean, Britain was desperately trying to avoid getting involved, and there were British ships sunk. I forget there's a number, 15 or so, and the British, you know, merchant seamen killed, and Britain did nothing, you know, and there's speeches in Parliament of people accusing, you know, all the rest of it of weakness and, but it's all within this context of, yeah, they didn't want to get involved, didn't want to, the famous quote, if you want to do it in depth in the future, I can do it and dig out these quotes of a senior civil servant, or Baldwin, I think it was, saying, whatever we do in Spain, we must never end up on the same side as the Soviet Union. Said that in the end we did end up on the side of the Soviet Union.
Of course.
But then it was like the priority, the main thing of the policy was to avoid that, you know?
Like, we told you this would happen. Okay, so that's a little insight into the history of a very fascinating period of time. Coming up to today, tell me, here we are in London, tell me about the International Brigades Memorial Trust.
Well, okay, well, the International Brigade Memorial Trust, and we were, I mean, we've only been founded or operating fairly recently. It was founded in 2001 when the veterans organisation, in other words, the men and women who had served in Spain, they were called the IBA, the International Brigade Association, decided to merge with the separate organisations, the Friends and Families of the International Brigades, which was like what it says on the tin. And out of the merger of those two organisations, the International Brigade Memorial Trust was formed. Our first president was Jack Jones, the great trade union and pensioners leader who had fought in Spain, been injured at the Ebro. And we started off quite modestly, like it says, there were about 40 or so veterans left alive at that time, and it was mainly family and a few friends and some historians who, you know, of the Spanish Civil War who founded it and were the first members. But I mean, it has to be said, to our surprise, we've grown and grown, and we've now got nearly 1,000 members, paying members. We've got a magazine that comes out 3 times a year. We've got an email newsletter. We hold major events around the country. We have an annual commemoration on the South Bank, where there's an absolutely fantastic memorial created by the sculptor Ian Walters to the International Brigades. We have a commemoration there the first Saturday each July. We have an annual lecture day on some theme. Next year it's in Oxford on the 23rd of March about, believe it or not, football and the Spanish Civil War. And we've got some great speakers. Sid Lowe is coming over from Madrid to speak at that. So, and then we have commemorations around the country in all the major cities, Glasgow, Manchester, Belfast, Dublin, Edinburgh. You name it, there are International Brigade memorials, and we hold commemorations there, and we've got local groups organising stuff, so we're very, very active. And it's you know, an interesting topic in itself, let alone the Spanish Civil War and the International Brigades, to know why it's still got such a kind of resonance today. I'm sure everyone's got ideas on why, but the fact that we've grown so much and we now Now there's only one of the veterans left alive, a chap called Jeffrey Cervante, who was a real youngster in Spain. He was a merchant seaman who jumped ship late in 1937. He's now aged 99 and lives in a nursing home in the Forest of Dean. He's the last one left alive, but we've grown, and now it's just we're a collection of people, enthusiasts who recognise the importance of keeping alive this amazing story, because you know the sad fact is no one else is going to really.
As I think we covered in the first half of the day, is already enough attempts to kind of discredit this history.
Forget about it.
It was from the off, really.
Yeah, it was from the off. I think there were too many inconvenient truths about it. Not only at the time that the British diplomatic policy was an outrage, to put it mildly, and a massive mistake. But even after the Second World War, with the Cold War, then Franco very cleverly kind of reinvented himself as this sort of bastion of anti-communism, pro-West. And although he was never fully accepted into the community of Western nations, so to speak, the US did put bases there, which took and basically he was accepted and as part of that Cold War narrative, if you like. And so for that to be possible, the Spanish Republicans and the people who supported them, talking about the International Brigade specifically, had to be painted as somehow kind of red dupes of Stalin and people who were just trying to create a communist dictatorship in Spain. All utter nonsense, completely ahistorical. There's no evidence for it. The Spanish Republic was a democracy, a legitimate constitutional democracy, and it remained so until it finally collapsed in March 1939. It was a coalition in which the communists were a minority in the cabinet. It was a coalition of everyone from anarchists, communists, socialists, Republican liberals, Cold War, so we're talking about into the 40s through the 50s, 60s and into the 70s, even when Franco died in 1975, there was this attempt, bolstered, it has to be said, by that thesis that we spoke about earlier, that the idea that the Republic lost because of infighting and because of Stalin. Supported by that, the official narrative, if you like, was that this was just a war between fascists and communists, and we were right to stay out of it, and at least Franco is an anti-communist and the real enemy are the communists. All complete nonsense. Just talk to any Spaniard who lived through the dictatorship, and they'll let you know. And of course, we now know all that was nonsense. Franco died in 1975, and then it was only after that, and then there was the restoration of democracy in Spain by the end of the 70s, and in fact the election of a socialist government in the 1980s, that normal service was resumed, so to speak. And since then, the attitude towards the international brigades began to change. They were seen quite rightly, as they should be, as the first people to fight fascism, and they have a very special place, not just in history of the left in Britain, in radical history. I mean, they have a very, very important place there, but they have a special place, or should have, in British history as well. But it's history that doesn't get taught. It's largely working class, radical history, and it's glossed over. You're lucky if in a school textbook, if the history of the 20th century will go from the First World War to the Second World War, they'll mention appeasement and Czechoslovakia, and you're lucky if they mention Spain, which is astonishing. If you look back at contemporary sources during the war in Spain, Spain was a huge big deal. It was massive. It was daily front page news, and it convulsed British society in the, in, I mean, the volunteers who went there. Remember, we're talking about people prepared to lay down their lives, because it was obvious from the start this was, as I said, not a gap year. This is somewhere, if you went, you were very likely to be killed. But these people were the tip of a very, very large movement, a mass movement, the Aid Spain movement, which raised in, some historians have said that the Aid Spain movement was the first of the great social movements of the 20th century. In other words, movements that spanned class, religion, even politics, an age, and whatever, you know, gender, and everything, and united people together in a single cause. And it was then after that came the other movements of, you know, for the peace movement, CND, and green, and feminist movements, and such like. But some people have argued that, historians argue that it was the first of the modern social movements. But it did, you know, I mean, in today's money, millions and millions of pounds were raised by ordinary people to send money and medicines to Spain, and indeed to support the international brigades. Many came back very badly injured and needed support. So it was part of a huge movement, which of course was now been, the story has been, understandably, because the Second World War came along and it eclipsed all that, and people soon forgot about Spain and everything was about the Second World War. So we're trying to keep that story alive, and it's extremely important. I mean, even something, I'll give you an example, the Dad's Army. Everyone's heard of Dad's Army because of the fantastic TV sitcom. Dad's Army, the Home Guard, was set up by two veterans of the British Battalion in the Spanish Civil War, Tom Winchingham and Hugh Slater. And I mean, on TV they portrayed as a cuddly collection of people, but the idea was that Tom Winchingham had was for a guerrilla army. I mean, people fully expected Nazi Germany to invade and overrun Britain, as he'd overrun France. So what Tom Winchingham, who had been the commander of the British Battalion at the Battle of Jarama outside Madrid in February 1937, wanted to do was to create a guerrilla army to fight, actually, not just the Nazis, but those people who collaborated with them. And I mean, it's quite funny looking back that Tom Winchingham, who had been, he was a veteran of the First World War, a founder member of the British Communist Party, had been studied at Balliol at Oxford, very well connected, and in fact he came back from Spain and became the defence correspondent of both the Picture Post, which was a mass circulation weekly magazine at the time, and also Tribune, the Labour left weekly.
Recently relaunched magazine.
Exactly, recently back in the news. And Tom Winchingham, he was a defence correspondent of both, and he persuaded the top brass and the politicians at the start of the war, Churchill included, to set up this Home Guard. But the Ministry of War people, the blimp, soon got wind of what he was doing, and he and Slater were quietly eased out, and it was and there was less focus on the guerrilla aspect and the bumping off the people who would have collaborated with the Nazis in Britain. But even to give great credit to the writers of the Dad's Army TV sitcom, there is one episode, and this is historically true, where Captain Mannering and the rest of it are given instructions by Spanish Republican dynamiters on blowing up bridges and the rest of it, and that's actually an episode, and they've obviously done the research, because that's what happened. It was at Austerley Park in West London where the Home Guard was set and where they were trained. And so, in other words, what I'm saying, to go back to the original point, is that you can't separate the Spanish Civil War from the Second World War. There's this continuity across so much that, I mean, another thing I point out is the Battle of the Ebro in the summer of and autumn of 1938, which was the last great battle of the Spanish Civil War. And the British Battalion lost 90 or so men there. The same airplanes that were bombing and strafing them on the banks of the Ebro then would soon be flying over London and the southeast of Britain. And we know that from research from one of our members in the Imperial War Museum, where he's dug up photos from the Battle of Britain and the Blitz, and found aircraft with markings from that obviously taken part in the Battle of the Ebro, with markings on the side, and matched them up with airplanes that had been at the Battle of the Ebro. So there's that continuity. It's the same German airplanes and pilots who were trying to kill the British volunteers in Spain in 1938 would soon be flying over Britain in the Battle of Britain.
John Bouts, all the rage, all the rage. On Trax FM, Trax FM.
Benito, just a quella, oh my god, I
thought.
Just a quella, it's Benito, just a quella, oh my god, I thought.
Spanish
weeks in my disco casino, the freedom fighters died up on the hill.
They sing the red flag,
they wore the black one after they died in for Mockingbird Hill.
Back from the buses,
went up in flashes, the Irish too,
drenched in blood.
Senoritas, those who spit in the bars.
Spanish bombs,
just a quiero infinito, just a quiera, oh my god, I thought.
Spanish bombs,
just a quiero infinito, just a quiera, oh my god, I thought.
The hillsides ring with
Benito, just a quiera, oh my god, I thought.
Just
a quiera, infinito, just a quiera, oh my god, I thought. Oh my god, I thought.
And you mentioned the Battle of Kerama, which I hope I'm pronouncing right.
Mm-hmm.
So I visited there myself and my partner visited with the International Brigades Memorial Memorial Trust, sorry, as part of a trip that was planned to go there for the anniversary. We went there for the 80th anniversary, but I understand that you do them every year.
They happen every year, yeah.
That, now, a couple of questions. I mean, firstly, very interesting historical trip. Like the hotel very much, nice place, and I loved Madrid. But aside from that, they were very trade union heavy. Is that a requirement for those trips, or can anyone apply?
Not at all. No. Obviously, we've got very strong links with the trade union movement, and that's for understandable reasons. I mean, just to on that point, those 2,500 volunteers from Britain, many were, I mean, they were young, obviously, so they weren't kind of senior figures in the labour movement. But they were, many of them, very, very active in their unions, or if not in their unions, in the unemployed workers movement, which was very large at the time, because we're talking now about the Great Depression, the years of great misery and hunger and joblessness in Britain. So many were local political activists, trade union activists. And so unions today are rightly proud of that history. That and many, in fact, like I mentioned, Jack Jones, but there were others, many came home from Spain and played a major role in British unions. If I can mention just another one, there's Thora Silverthorne, who was the daughter of a Welsh miner, trained to be a nurse, trained at in Reading and Oxford, in fact, and went to Spain, served in Spain throughout the whole, through the, virtually all the war, in frontline hospitals, terrible conditions, doing amazing work, as they all did, the medical volunteers. She came back, and she set up the, well, she did two things worthy of note. She set up the first trade union for nurses. We're not talking about the RCN. She said, well, they need a proper union. And that union subsequently merged with a union called NUP, National Union of Public Employees, which is now part of Unison. And of course, Unison now represents many nurses, and it's down to this Thora Silverthorne who did it. Now, she also not only did that, but she was one of the leading members of the Socialist Medical Association, which maybe not too many people have heard of it these days, but was one of the architects of the NHS. They were consulted by Nye Bevin and the people in the great Clem Attlee Labour government of 1945 on the creation of the NHS. So Thora was involved in that. So that's just another example of someone who, I mean, she was a young woman when she went to Spain, but in later life played a major role in the British Labour movement. So yes, unions rightly feel very proud of that heritage of the Spanish Civil War. And of course the values that took those men and women to Spain are fundamental values of the labour movement. We're talking about anti-fascism and international solidarity. But going back to the trips, yeah, they're every Jarama is a valley just southeast of Madrid. And it was, I referred earlier to the time when Franco arrives at the gates of Madrid in November 1936, and there was fighting from November 36 through to December 1936 on the western outskirts of Madrid, and he was stopped by the Spanish units with the help of the international brigades. So Franco tried early in 1937, he tried a different tactic. He thought he'd surround the city, in other words cut it off from the rest of Republican Spain, and the main road from Madrid to Valencia, which was the lifeline for Madrid, runs through the Jarama, or crosses the Jarama Valley. So Franco tried to capture the Madrid-Valencia highway, and from that came the Battle of Jarama, which was fought out in February 1937. There were some 120 British volunteers were killed, so it was a terrible, in terms of loss of life, a terrible battle. But the British battalion, in fact, played a heroic part in it. They were players at key moments in the battle, one doesn't want to overstate this because many tens of thousands of people took part in the battle. But the British battalion did play a very leading role in protecting and saving the Madrid-Valencia highway from being cut off. And it's for that reason it's got a special place in all the, I mean, there's a great song, Valley of Jarama, that's been sung over the years by Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and Billy Bragg about the Battle of Jarama. So that's remembered. And all our commemorations, or many of our International Brigade Memorial Trust commemorations, end with singing of the Battle of Jarama, or the Valley of Jarama.
Some of the ways you can contact the International Brigade Memorial Trust is by phone, if you're in Britain, because this is an international show. 0207 253 8748. You can email inquiries at international international-brigades.org.uk, and the website is www.internationalbrigades.org.uk, where you can also find the Twitter page and the Facebook page.
We're not hard to find, and do if you're at all interested. I mean, we still come across family members who didn't know we existed, you know, people who know their family story, that they're, you know, great uncle or grandfather or whatever, or great aunt was in Spain, and they're very proud of that story, and for one reason or another don't know we're around. We're keeping that story alive, and in fact we have amazing records. We have a biographical database of nearly all the 2,500 volunteers from Britain, with basic information about them, you know, their addresses, their birth, their date of birth, what happened to them, and the rest of it. So do get in touch and do support us. As I said, we're a charity, completely voluntary organisation. We've got no employees or anything. It's just a group of enthusiasts and like-minded people who keep the whole show on the road. And but we're determined the show will stay on the road and stay on the road even after we're all gone. There's clearly interest, a lot of interest, in this piece of amazing piece of British history, and we're determined to keep it alive.
All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.